Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. The Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You could use a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast, but it's simpler to use a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports and find advice for listening to shortwave at home. Please check out the website and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from France 24, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, and Radio Havana Cuba. We will begin with France 24. First, a press review from Israeli and Arab media about the Israeli parliament banning UNRWA, that's UNRWA, which is the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for Palestine. Then from the New York Times, a piece about the widespread use of herbicides in the Amazon forest, not unlike what is done in the Pacific Northwest forests. Then from an edition of Perspective, speaking with John Christensen, director of the United Nations Environmental Program's Copenhagen Climate Center. The topic is the recent warning from the United Nations that efforts to reduce climate change must be applied at once, as evidenced by the increasing extreme weather events of the past 2 years. They say that fossil fuel consumption must be sharply cut back at once, or the 1.5-degree Paris Agreement will be impossible. The United Nations is urging countries to implement their plans to reduce carbon now. And he speaks to the absence of the subject in the U.S. presidential campaign. Then press reviews from Russia and South Korea about North Korean troops in Russia. France 24.
Going back to one of our top stories to start, Leo, the news that Israel's parliament has voted to ban UNRWA from operating in the country. What's been the reaction from the Israeli and Arab press?
I'll start in Israel because, as you'll see, the wording's very different depending on where you might get your news. This is Israel Hayom, which is the country's most read newspaper. It's often been criticised for being a mouthpiece for Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. On the front page of their site today, this is their headline: Israel ends ties with terrorist-linked UNRWA, which is, of course, the UN's Palestinian Refugee Agency. They report that during the Knesset deliberations on the law, they were shown video evidence of UNRWA's personnel's involvement in terrorism. And they said, given this background and having proved that UNRWA and employees acted against Israel, the state must determine that UNRWA's activities in the country must cease. So that's a brief look at Israel, but what about the Arab world? Well, I'll start with Arab News, which is a Saudi-based publication, but backed by the Saudi government. They say that the legislation risks collapsing the already fragile process of distributing aid in Gaza. Well, the Middle East Eye, which is London-based but funded by Qatar, report that 7 of Israel's allies have condemned the ban, the foreign ministers of 7 different countries releasing a joint statement. Germany, France, Britain, Australia, Canada, Japan and South Korea all warned that the bill could have devastating consequences. The bills will prohibit Israeli officials from providing services or dealing with UNRWA employees, an outright ban on UNRWA from operating in areas under Israeli control, particularly in northern Gaza. I'll finish with The Guardian. They have this editorial piece this morning. They say that the banning of the agency with no replacement will only cripple the Palestinians in their hour of need. It's a deeply irresponsible move by Israeli lawmakers, they say, which exhibits a brazen contempt for the global norms that govern human rights, conflict, and diplomacy.
Antonio, moving south now to the Amazon rainforest, while the COP16 for biodiversity is still ongoing and looking for new ways to protect our natural world, it seems that others are innovating to destroy it. What can you tell us about chemical deforestation?
Yes, this is a piece in the New York Times, a long read about this phenomenon of chemical deforestation. If you look at that absolute desolate wasteland, I can tell you a bit more about it. So Brazil generally monitors deforestation using satellite images on which you can track the abrupt disappearance of trees through things like fires and chainsaw demolition, if you will. However, there have been an estimated 180 square miles of Brazil chemically deforested since 2010. Now, this is a specific area in the Pantanal wetland, which is the world's largest wetland, an essential area for the protection of biodiversity, in which an area the size of New York City was dried out and died off, prosecutors think, by herbicide. When authorities went to the site, they discovered cattle roaming and stashes of huge quantities of empty herbicide containers. The land belongs to a rancher named Claudice Oliveira Lemes, who is an international beef magnate, if you will, and he has now been charged by Brazilian authorities for one of the country's biggest single acts of illegal deforestation in its history. Prosecutors are calling for him to pay $1 billion in compensation if found guilty. They say there is evidence that he hired a plane to spray the chemicals and that he made a purchase of $3 million worth of toxic defoliants. Authorities in Brazil suspect this is a much more common practice than we realise, but it is difficult to prove. What's for sure is it does lasting damage, leaving these toxic herbicides in the soil, which can also, of course, pollute the waterways, not to mention the fact that aerial spraying of herbicides can, of course, have an extremely dangerous impact on human health.
Now, it's time for today's perspective. And extreme heat waves, storms, droughts and floods are already ravaging communities, and that is with less than 1.5 Celsius of global heat warming to date. And the UN is warning that the crunch time for the planet is now real, and that any time left for climate delays has already run out. The UN's environment programme saying that political courage is now needed to end the world's fossil fuel addiction. Well, joining us now is director of the UN Environment Programme's Copenhagen Climate Centre, John Christensen. Thanks very much for joining us on the programme. First of all, tell us then in your latest report how bad you think the latest situation is.
Well, it's basically just a continuation of what we've been saying over a number of years. And I mean, the situation right now is emissions are still going up by about 1% compared to last year. And what we are looking at from the science side, if you want to believe you can still stay at that 1.5 degree in the longer term, you need to reduce by 2030, which is only 5 years and a bit away, by 42, almost half of your emissions need to be down at that time. And we just simply haven't seen that kind of movement yet. The reason we are crying alert, especially loud this year, is because countries are committed to coming with new climate pledges to the climate convention next year. So therefore, we want to sort of raise the red flag before they go into the annual climate meeting in Baku later in November.
We've heard, of course, nothing but calls for action on climate change for well over a decade now. We've had nothing but pledges. I mean, has it made a difference so far, or is the difference has been made so small that it's negligible?
Somewhere in between, I'd say. If you look at where we would have been heading if we didn't have the Paris Agreement that we got in 2015 and seen the reductions that have coming, I mean, then we have seen a positive movement compared to what it would have been otherwise. So, I mean, it can be done, but it's not happening far enough and fast enough.
So do you have any hope at all in the politicians?
Yeah, well, you just had this sort of sequence about US politics, and I think one theme that hasn't been mentioned once in the election is climate. So it's sometimes difficult to be optimistic in that sense. But, I mean, what we have in the report this year also is a technical analysis of what is the current possibilities in power, forestry, all kinds of areas. And technically, if you want to do it, it can be done. That's the main message. There's technologies like wind, solar, forest management and so on can deliver the reductions needed. But it does require that you act now and not wait 5 or 10 years, because then 1.5 degrees is easily gone in actually in a few years if we don't act.
Yeah, let's talk about some of those that are in your report. You mentioned it there briefly, the faster rollout of solar and wind energy. And you say that could provide 27% of the emissions cut needed. I mean, that's a huge chunk of it, isn't it?
Yeah. But it's, I mean, you could say a lot of it is happening already in the market now because solar is competitive in most countries. If you want to make it, I mean, one of the problems is developing countries can easily do more, but for them, capital is often a constraint, so they need financial assistance to be able to implement. You can do really large-scale solar in many African countries, for instance. A lot is happening in Morocco, where they have the biggest solar plant in the world, but you need to find the financing and the off-taking. So it's also not just about whether the individual technology can deliver, but if you can create the system around it, the policies, the financing mechanisms. And we also talk about the need for additional finance to make all this happen in the report. So and it's a combination.
The other one you briefly mentioned was stopping the destruction of forests, I assume notably the Amazon. That could bring another 20% cut.
Yeah, and reforestation in an area that has been deforested over time. So you basically rebuild the resource, or you get into some kind of more sustainable use of biomass where you have a rotation system so you can use it for energy purposes, but you replant the whole time. So I think it is something where you can sort of, you can see the potentials, but it does require really urgent and quite strong political action, plus international collaboration, because all that power would also need more transformation lines and so on. I mean, I live in Copenhagen. We're connected to Sweden, Germany, Norway, England with power lines, and I just checked my meter this morning and I have about 88% renewables in my system right now. So it's workable, it can be done.
Why do you think politicians don't pay enough attention? I mean, as you said, it's pretty obvious, isn't it, that we're starting already to see major effects of climate change. And yet, as you say, in the US, it's hardly been mentioned at all.
I think maybe several things, but I mean, one thing is that this is kind of a long-term thing, and in politics, often things are about the short-term, what you need to do for the next year or two. And I think also the concept of sort of green transition has been seen as something which comes with a big cost, and it really doesn't. But there's a lot of sort of inertia in the understanding of the system, plus, of course, there's a lot of economic interest in fossil fuels. I don't think you should underestimate that the fossil fuel companies have had the best years in the last 2 or 3 years in terms of profits. So even if finance should be going out of fossil industry, it's really attractive to be there.
And of course, the politicians are competing with all sorts of other demands on them as well, notably the war in the Middle East, notably Ukraine, all those other issues and needs for people, which is sucking up finances, whereas perhaps it should be going in other areas.
Yeah, I mean, that's, of course, part of it right now, because so much is going into war in different areas. And if just a part of that could be directed into action, that would really help a lot. At the same time, of course, countries are facing increasing impacts at the same time. So it's a real challenge that you have to deal. If you take an industrialized country, you have to basically do your own adaptation and deal with impacts. You have to change your energy system and maybe building and recycling and whatever. At the same time, you need to provide sort of finances, support to developing countries to do their bit. And it's, of course, a challenge. But I mean, the thing in many energy power areas, it's really something you could do with private capital and make it commercial. I mean, it's at a stage where it's not about government money, it's more about private investments.
If we do nothing, what does it mean?
It means we will be in trouble. I mean, we have in the report where we sort of say, if we just continue doing what we do right now, then by the end of the century, we're going to be around 3 degrees over sort of temperatures that we compare with pre-industrialized. So we're about 1.5 now, just under 1.5. And the UN climate panel, the IPCC, made a report a few years ago illustrating what's the difference in impacts between 1.5, 2, and 3. And 3 is definitely not a place you want to be. I mean, it's going to be unmanageable in terms of impacts.
And yet still we're in this situation where little, I'm sure you would argue, is being done and not quickly enough.
Yes, and that's why we're hoping, first of all, to get countries to accelerate what they've already promised to do, because there's still what we call an implementation gap also, that they're not fully implementing what they promised in Paris and in Glasgow some years ago. And of course, having all this information, also about the opportunities, because solar, wind, and some of the other things have become radically cheaper since Paris. So it's also understanding the new business case. It's not the same as we talked about 10 years ago. I mean, it's much, much, much cheaper to do renewable energy now, and also electrical mobility has come in big time. So there are sort of hope from the technology side that there are options that you can put into your plans and implement fairly quickly.
Great to have you with us on the programme today. Thanks very much for joining us. John Christensen, who's at UN Environment Programme's Copenhagen Climate Centre.
Let's start with a piece in the Moscow Times, a Russian paper, with the headline, North Koreans fighting for Russia put warm words into practice. In other words, this has been much mooted. However, further down in this article, they point out that Russia is taking a risk here. Of course, South Korea has thus far sent only non-lethal aid to Ukraine. And of course, we've got an article from the Korea Times in which they go over South Korea mulling their response to this. One of the things that they point out in this article is that South Korea fears, first of all, North Korea gaining battlefield experience, which would make them a more dangerous adversary and neighbour, and also wondering what North Korea is getting in return from Russia. And they say that if, for instance, it's advanced military technology or weaponry, that's the kind of thing that they would respond to potentially with military aid to Ukraine directly. They say it could be defensive or offensive, depending on the degree of engagement by the North Koreans in this war. And they say regardless, they'll be sharing intelligence with their allies and are already sending a delegation to NATO, also emphasising that South Korea will be sure to make sure the North Koreans find out about this. Pyongyang still denies this, that it's rumour, but they think that the North Korean people would be outraged to discover.
Those press reviews and interview were from France 24, which may be easily found at their website, france24.com, as well as a YouTube channel called France 24 English. They're also available at most podcast sites, as is the shortwave report. Next, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. Israel has launched airstrikes in and around the Lebanese ancient city of Baalbek after warning the entire area to evacuate. Many of the evacuees were Lebanese who had gone there to avoid the bombing of their homes in the south. Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
To the conflict in the Middle East now, and Israel has launched airstrikes in and around the ancient Lebanese city of Baalbek, hours after issuing an evacuation warning. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah. The region is known as a stronghold of the militants. Around 80,000 people live in the city, and many fled there to take refuge from Israeli bombardment in Lebanon's south. Now, Baalbek is known for its Roman temples, which are a UNESCO World Heritage Site. Journalist Stella Mena is in Beirut for us. Stella, what's the situation in Baalbek right now? What do we know?
The Israeli army had carried out a series of airstrikes on Baalbek and the surrounding villages. Local journalists who are reporting on the ground say that they have witnessed at least 9 attacks. It seems like this first wave of airstrikes has now stopped, but we do not know if Israel might target the area again throughout the next couple of hours. We also don't have any reports yet on casualties. The attacks and airstrikes on Baalbek came approximately 4 hours after Israel had ordered the entire city to evacuate. This is the first time that the Israeli army has sent out these warnings and called on an entire city to be evacuated. Within this area are also the ancient Roman temples that are one of the largest worldwide, and they are part of the UNESCO World Heritage. The people in Baalbek took this warning quite serious. Thousands of them tried to leave the city, which caused massive traffic jams on the main roads that take outside of Baalbek.
Baalbek is in the east of the country. It's about 100 kilometers from Israel's border, relatively far. Why is this city so significant for Israel?
Well, the Israeli army says that it has targeted a fuel depot by Hezbollah. Yet again, it is a statement coming from a party involved in the war, so we cannot verify at the moment whether this is true or not. What we can say is that the Bekaa Valley, this region in the east of Lebanon, where Baalbek is situated in, is an area where Hezbollah is quite strong. But why an entire city now had to be evacuated is not very clear to us here, because, yes, the Hezbollah is strong within this region, but Baalbek is not a city that where only Hezbollah members are living. There are also normal families, civilians living in the city. And like we mentioned before, also the ancient ruins, the ancient Roman temples are located in the heart of the city.
That report interview was from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com, as well as at YouTube at their channels called DW News and DW Documentary. They're also available at most podcast sites. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could help support this program, there's a link for online donations available at my website, outfarpress.com, or you could write to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Many, many thanks to everyone who's ever helped keep this freely distributed show airborne. Please join them. And if you're listening on a public radio station, please help support them as well. We will conclude with Radio Havana, Cuba. Lebanon has launched a complaint with the United Nations Security Council demanding a condemnation of Israeli attacks on their country. Over 2,400 Lebanese people have been killed so far. Israeli bombings of UN schools in Gaza City continue, resulting in 3 more journalists being killed, bringing the total to 180 journalists killed in a little over a year. Central London has seen large demonstrations against right-wing extremism, which created violent race riots this past summer. Radio Havana, Cuba.
Lebanon says it's lodged a complaint with the UN Security Council, demanding the condemnation of Israel's ongoing aggression against the Arab country and urging the international community to hold the occupying regime accountable for its war crimes. Lebanese Foreign Ministry said in a statement on Sunday that the complaint calls for condemning the Israeli invasion of its territories and the violation of the country's sovereignty, as well as the widespread and continuous attacks on the security and safety of its people. The complaint also calls for obligating Israel to implement Resolution 1701 to halt its hostilities immediately and withdraw Israeli troops from Lebanese territory, this the ministry added. According to the statement, Lebanon further noted in the complaint that Israel has no respect for the international law, adding that it has escaped accountability and questioning by the global community. Meanwhile, Lebanon's health ministry said an Israeli strike in the southern Lebanese port city of Sidon has killed at least 2 people and injured 11 others. Lebanon's national news agency, the NNA, also reported that 3 people have been killed in an Israeli air attack on the town of Zawta al-Sharqiyah in Nabatish. Earlier in the day, NNA reported that Israeli warplanes had raided the town of Yahma al-Shakif, destroying 2 houses, while another house was damaged in an overnight attack on the village of Duair. Since late September, Israel has launched an intense air and ground offensive against Lebanon after nearly a year of cross-border exchanges with the Lebanese resistance movements, Hezbollah, over the war in Gaza. As many as 2,483 Lebanese people have been killed and 11,628 others wounded as a result of the regime's intensified attacks against the country. At least 9 people, including a 9-year-old Palestinian girl and 3 journalists, have been killed in Israeli airstrike on a UN-run school sheltering displaced people in Gaza City. Hamas said in a statement that, quote, US-backed Zionist warplanes bombed the Asmaa school in Al-Shati camp west of Gaza City, end quote. This on Sunday. It said 3 journalists and a 9-year-old child were amongst the victims of the airstrike. Tragically, 9-year-old Zama Al-Ghul was killed today by an Israeli strike while waiting to receive a biscuit at Asma school in the Shati refugee camp in Gaza City. Gaza's media office identified the slain journalist Saeed Radwan from the Al-Aqsa TV, Hamza Abu Salmiye from Sanad News Agency, and Hanin Barood, who works for Al-Quds Foundation. That brings to 180 the total number of journalists killed in Gaza since October the 7th, 2023. The media office called on the international community and the press organizations to intervene, quote, to deter the occupation and pursue it in international courts for its ongoing crimes and pressure it to stop its ongoing genocide and the killing of Palestinian journalists, unquote. Shortly after the strike in Gaza, Israeli forces attacked yet another UN-run school in southern Lebanon, killing at least 5 people. Supporters of far-right activist Tommy Robinson are holding a rally in the British capital, while thousands from across the UK take to the streets of central London in a counter-demonstration against right-wing extremism. One organiser of the counter-protest said, quote, "We've come down from Glasgow today to stand in solidarity with other trade unionists and anti-racists and anti-fascists against the mobilisation of the far-right." But far from the counter-demonstrations, those who find immigrants the reason behind the socio-economic woes of white working-class Britons are marching. The detained leader goes by the alias Tommy Robinson, was behind the violent race riots this summer. Ahead of the march, he was arrested by the police upon his return from abroad under counter-terrorism legislation. Sabi Dalou, an organizer with Stand Up to Racism, said, quote, "The Islamophobic riots that swept across England and the north of Ireland at the end of July and the beginning of August shocked the world. He is an Islamophobe and he is stirring up hatred, particularly towards Muslims, but also refugees. He's trying to build a far-right street movement behind him, and that movement supports Nigel Farage and Reform UK. So it's a very dangerous movement that could drag British politics to the right."
Those reports were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's website is working well at radiohc.cu. There's no podcast, however. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, or 6100. At their website, radiohc.cu, you could stream the English version at noon, Monday through Friday, Pacific Daylight Saving Time. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to please listen to international broadcast, get a global perspective. You do have to look even harder these days because of US and EU prohibitions on media. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find information for online donations. There's a link at the website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 28th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.